Cunningham for another extraordinary message on Gill Athletics Connections.
All right, we're back here on the Gill Athletics Connections podcast. So humbled that you pressed play today. We're excited about today's guest. We're excited about all of our guests, and really just pumped to continue the journey, the mission of getting every coach in the whole country, high school, junior high, college, elite. We want them all. It's like Pokemon. I want to catch them all here, and I'm excited to catch this one today. So help me welcome from the University of Alabama, the coach, the wise, the wonderful Mr. Nick Stinoff. Nick, how are you today, sir?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
I thought it was law that anytime someone said, how are you? Or, you know, how you do it, for Alabama, it was automatic. You just said Roll Tide. Like, that's just the answer for every question.
Roll Tide is a response like, hi, how are you? Welcome. Roll Tide.
You know, I grew up in the great state of Alabama, high school and college there. I went to the number one college in the state of Alabama, Troy University, but grew up close enough to Auburn that Auburn was kind of number two. But it's hard to be in Alabama without having some respect and reverence for the University of Alabama. And really, you know, I know a lot of people know it from the football team, of course, with Coach Saban and whatnot. You know, the track team has certainly stepped up in the last, call it a 5-10 years here now, that's for sure. But the university is, it's a really like academic, good university. It was quite amazing as I started kind of digging into the university itself. So it's really interesting. Well, we're excited to learn how you got there. You're not an Alabama. Well, I don't know that you're not an Alabama native. I know you weren't at Alabama for your whole career. So we're excited to check out that and learn more about that. You are a distance coach. So, you know, certainly no questions about how to make a distance runner run fast, because I know nothing about distance. If I was a distance coach, they'd all be doing long runs every day. I'd just be like, all right, you're going to be aerobic monsters. That's all I would ever know. And, you know, I'd move on. So we won't talk about that. That's for sure. So let's talk about you, Nick. Let's kind of get in our Wayback Machine here. Let's talk about track and distance running, and maybe other sports. Where does track coaching, where does all that begin for you?
Yeah, I was originally a soccer player. Grew up, love for soccer, played high school, played club ball. I actually played my first 2 years in college, believe it or not. So I didn't run cross country until my junior year in college. First time ever.
Really?
And what's fun about that is, so I never had a 5K in cross. I never had an 8K in cross. My first ever cross country race was actually a 10K.
Welcome to the big leagues. Yeah.
Yep. So my love for it, I should say, kind of came from there.
Yeah. Well, before we get there, so then tell me about high school. Did you run track? So were you soccer in the fall, track in the spring? Tell me more.
Yeah. Soccer and then track. But kind of track came on. It's a funny story. I had somebody on my street. So I grew up on a street with a lot of kids. You know, you're always out there, as you remember, you know, playing football, we're playing baseball, we're racing each other up and down the street, we're on bikes, we're just playing a lot. And one of the neighborhood kids who I knew I was faster than ended up being the track captain. He was a year or two older than I was. And so he came home bragging one day, like, I'm the captain of track. And I was like, man, track took you. Like, we've raced each other all the time growing up. So I was like, all right, I'll go out for track. So it was kind of like a friendly, competitive, you know, atmosphere. And then my soccer coach was actually one of the track coaches. He coached hurdles and jumps and kind of did a little bit. We had a different distance coach, but he was always encouraging the soccer guys, if you're not doing anything, you know, come out and run track, right? And he was like, hey, I know soccer is our first love, and I know you play club ball. So, you know, on Tuesdays and Thursdays was my club soccer practice. He's like, you don't have to come to track practice. You can come Monday, Wednesday, Friday. You can play soccer. You can do. So I was like, okay, well, it's not going to interfere with my soccer. Might as well. And then it kind of just transpired from there. All of a sudden I started running. I started running faster, started having a little bit more success. And then, you know, junior and senior year, I didn't really start running track in high school until junior year. So senior year, it kind of really took off. And I was like, oh, maybe I want to do this in college. So,
and you know, one of the things I have to work hard at here as being the host here is not having assumptions. I'm really bad at when I know someone's from a school, I just, you know, my whole assumption is, oh, your whole life has been, and because I know you, I know it's not true here, but it's like, oh, Nick's been in Alabama forever and you're a distance coach. I'm like, oh, so you obviously were a distance runner and did nothing but distance. What are you doing event? Are you doing like the mile and 2 mile during this junior, senior year? Or you're kind of giving me vibes of like you're sprinting and things like that.
I had every range. It was actually crazy.
Yeah.
So when I first started, they had me in the mile and 2 mile, like almost everything, right? And I was like, no, I want to run. So they ran me. I was on 4x4s. I was 800. I was more an 800 guy in
Okay.
high school, but they'd run me up into the mile and 2 mile every now and then, especially in dual meets, right, to get points. And
Right.
but no, I was more of an 800 guy.
And where are we? Where are you growing up at?
So I grew up in Syracuse, New York.
Got it. Okay. All right. All right. So
Nice cold Syracuse,
yeah,
New York.
exactly. Yeah. So keep going. You were saying senior year, it started kind of getting a little bit more serious on the track side.
Yeah, so I was okay. I was like a 50 point 400 guy. I ended up running 153 on relays, 154, 800 meter,
Yeah.
like a 420 miler. Never really raced a 2 mile. Raced a 2 mile, did it in dual meets, like I said, for points. But yeah, really just did everything. I did four events probably every dual meet. Even ran on the 4x1. 4x4, everything. So that's actually probably something for me. I was on the state qualifying team in the 4x1, the 4x4, the 4x8, and the open eight.
Wow, holy cow, my dude's got range.
Yeah, so whatever coach needed, whatever the team needed, I just kind of did. I loved it.
I love and there's a real lesson here. When you talked about the soccer coach and the track coach and practices, and you had club soccer, which that's a very big topic. It's just funny. It was a topic for you back when you were growing up, and now today it feels like that's a topic every day. Club coaching, club sports versus high school sports, etc. I love that kind of lesson of the communication side of it. It's like, okay, you're gonna do club. Coach didn't try to talk you out of it, but it's like, okay, you're gonna do club on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Cool, we'll work around that. You're not gonna do track practice those days, and we'll modify. I assume they modified Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Did you realize, and you can be forgiven as a 17, 18-year-old kid, but did you realize, I don't want to say how special that is. Was that common in your area? Like, did you have other soccer players or other sports people working dual sports at the same time? Or was it kind of like, yeah, Nick's a little different. He's good at soccer and we want him on the track team, so we're going to work around it.
A little of both. I would say our better soccer players kind of ran or did something else. Like some of them played lacrosse or, dual sport athlete, especially at my school. It wasn't very large. I mean, I graduated with about 260, 265. So fair enough. But like I would say our better soccer players were dual sport. And I think my coach, he was the soccer coach, basketball coach, and the track coach. So he understood the dynamic of, multi-sport athletes. And yeah, that was good.
It's funny you just said that, and this kind of just popped into my head. I'm a big believer in multi-sport athletes. I think especially in high school, they should play everything, even at the detriment of whatever their number one sport is. And I see it feels like on the track side, we lead with the, hey, there should be multi-sport athletes. Like, if my track kids want to play football and soccer and volleyball, great, go do it. We'll work around it. And because of that, it seems like the reverse is true. It feels like, and I'm hearing the one side of it, the track coach side of it, the football coach only wants you to do football and 7-on-7 and spring practice and volleyball club, it's 365, et cetera. I wonder. And certainly there's a club aspect to it, but that made me think about, like, is the amount of coaches, you mentioned your soccer coach was the basketball coach and a track coach. I remember, growing up in Alabama, and all of our football coaches were all the other sport coaches. There was no single, like, no one just did basketball. You were a football coach who did basketball, a football coach who did tennis, football coach who did track. I wonder, are we losing it, multi-sport coaches on the high school level? Are more coaches specializing in high school?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I would
Yeah.
say, you probably find more now that are cross country and then indoor and outdoor track.
Right.
I would say it depends probably too on the size of the school. I bet you the smaller schools, you have a lot of coaches who probably do multi-sports. Yeah.
I remember when I first moved to Chicago, and I called the local high school, De La Salle, to see if they needed a volunteer or assistant, whatnot. And I'm talking to the head coach, and I asked him, I was like, "So, what position do you coach in football?" And he was like, "What are you talking about?" I mean, it was like, "What are you talking about, idiot?" I mean, it was literally like, "What are you talking?" And I was like, "Oh, well, where I come from, every football, all the other sport coaches come from football." And he's
Yeah.
like, "Oh no, dude." He's like, Our football coaches coach football. We've got a whole separate basketball staff, wrestling staff, and it blew my little Alabama mind. Trust me, it blew my mind. Had no idea. So yeah, I don't know. I don't necessarily pigeonhole you to give us the answer on that question. It just kind of made me think about: are we losing multi-sport coaches in high school? Is that affecting the multi-sport athlete? So anyway, okay. Let's get back to you, Nick. You know, we almost called this podcast the Tangent Podcast because I knew I would just, you know, interject your story and be like, well, what is this? Yeah. What's going on here? Senior year, you're running on every stinking relay from the 4x1 to the 4x8. You're doing the miles. Quite amazing. I didn't hear any field events. So, you know, maybe not the decathlete route. But as you start looking towards college, you're a soccer player and track. Would you have called yourself a soccer player who ran track or track athlete who, I kind of think I know the answer here, that played soccer?
So if you were to ask high school me, I'd say I was a soccer player that ran track.
Right.
Now, looking back on it in hindsight, you know, as we get older, I was definitely a track runner who played soccer. I was far better at track and didn't realize it. And I never had anyone really kind of steer me in that direction. Well, subtly now looking back on it, I can see some coaches, but really they kind of let me do it. In hindsight, I probably should have made the transition to track sooner.
Yeah, that's it. You can't feel like now you're like, oh, I was masquerading as a soccer player. I was really a track guy, but I was wearing the Halloween costume of a soccer player. Yeah, that's interesting. Perspective is amazing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
What is it? Hindsight's 2020. We can look back and be like, oh, man, what was I thinking? What would have happened if I'd have done it earlier, right? Yeah, that's the.
But I had fun with it, though. I tell recruits this all the time. It made me probably love it for longer and enjoy what I was doing in the moment. So I just want you to have fun with it.
Interesting.
And I truly mean that. So when I talk to athletes who are multi-sport, like I have one recruit who's a soccer player, and I was like, hey, do it for as long as you can. Because if you know you're going to be a runner and you know you're doing that in college, I want you to continue loving it. So I've encouraged that. And I think that's something special to have.
Yeah, that's really cool. The alternative is, hey, you're good at this sport, so go all in. You know, you hear this, and this is, you know, quite often a refrain of go all in, give it your all, 100%, block out the distractions. And it's like, yeah, you're talking about an 18-year-old. And really, even in college, you're talking about a 20-year-old. That's, you know, when we look at where our athletes are doing the best in any sport, soccer, baseball, basketball, track, it's 28 to 32 because you need years of layering on there. And it's like, why are we doing this at 20 years old and 18 years old and 16 years old? And God bless, you know, more and more younger and younger, 12 years old. That's awesome. And you should have fun. I love that kind of attitude. Where does that come from? Is that a, you know, that most of our traits that we know at our age and stage of life come from background, whether it's teachers or parents or clergy, et cetera. Where does that, like, hey man, have fun with it. Where does that kind of attitude come from for you?
Probably started with my family, right? Mm-hmm. And then my high school coach, right, who was very open to kind of just making sure I was enjoying it. Like, he always used to have this thing. He'd come up and ask me, like, how you feeling? So I'd be like, I feel right. He's like, oh, good. Okay, good. You feel rough. Like, he'd kind of joke about it and kind of make it fun and make the atmosphere enjoyable. And, you know, I had a really healthy relationship with him. I still talk with him nowadays. And wow, looking back on it, I first met him around 2000. So I've known him for about 23 years now. And so we still have that healthy, fun, cordial, you know, kind of enjoying, laughable, enjoy, you know, kind of conversation. And I wanted to apply that because I'm like, yeah, at the end of the day, like, there's going to be certain times when we're going to work hard and running, let's face it, there's so many miles and so many workouts and long runs and stuff that are not glamorous. But if we can enjoy the process and I can make them laugh and keep it, you know, fun, you know, that's important to me.
We love shout outs. What's coach's name?
Oh, so Coach Scott Love was my first coach, and then Coach Mark Carr. He's nice. Still currently at my old high school, East Syracuse Manoa, still coaching away. So both of them are still really big in my life. But yeah.
Love it. The impact of a coach, man. It's immeasurable. It really is. You know, what they did for you, and it's interesting. If you're watching us on YouTube, you can actually see Nick's face here. But the way your face lit up when, you know, saying their name, you know, I know you have your memories when you're telling the story, but when you say their names out loud, it makes it more tangible for a person. So when you said that, your face lit up even more, and it really tells you, you know, the impact that they made on you and are still making on you as mentors today and still talking to them. And now what's amazing is, you know, they get to see their legacy through you and what you're doing with the athletes. It's really an extension of their legacy and impact on young people. So I love seeing that. Like I said, that's why we started publishing these on YouTube, because it's one thing to hear the voice, and you can certainly hear that in Nick's voice here. But if you go on YouTube and actually see that light up, it's special. It really is special. Okay, as you're looking into college, tell us, first of all, where is coaching in your mind, if at all? Like, are you thinking like, oh, maybe I could be a coach? Where are you looking to go in for academically? And because you're still this, pretty high level dual athlete, and are you thinking soccer, track, both, neither? Tell us about that process.
I was looking for both right out. Crazy story with the start of it. So I was looking for both, more on the soccer route actually right mm-hmm. away. I went to Coastal Carolina for a semester.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Was a walk-on soccer, was talking with the coach, redshirted. They had a really, really good team back then. So kind of redshirted, was on the track team, on the cross country team. And back then, the coach that was there and recruited me, when I showed up on campus, found out that he actually ended up leaving. So I go all the way down to Coastal Carolina, want to do both, start to get my feet wet in both. And then all of a sudden the coach for track leaves, new coach comes in, and he's like, hey, if you're going to do this, you got to pick one or the other. So I was like, okay, well, that's not why I came here originally. And the coach I really liked, and things were kind of, I was far from home. So I then, at that time, Coach Scott Love, who coached me a little bit in high school, ended up taking a Division III position up at Nazareth College in Rochester, New York.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember calling him for advice, because, again, he was one of my high school coaches, along with Coach Mark Carr, and was kind of just like throwing out there, hey, this is what happened. I don't know what I want to do. I don't know if this is where I want to be. It's kind of far from home. Things aren't going right. And he was like, well, I just started and took over the Division III position here. And I knew the soccer coach at the time actually as well. And he was like, if you want to do both, Division III is kind of a good area for you to be a dual sport athlete. A lot of Division I's might try to pigeonhole you and, put you in one. And so I was like, okay, it's an hour and a half from home. I know the coaches already. Why don't I just go and do both? I know the area. I have a lot of friends who were in the Rochester area growing up in Syracuse. So yeah, I moved back home and went in the Division III route and played both.
Wow. What were you academically thinking? Like, for to me, and I'll say this every show, it still boggles me that we make 18-year-olds pick a major, which is going to affect their professional life for the rest of, like, at 18 years old. I mean, it just still, I don't have a solution, but oh my gosh, 18 is just crazy. What were you thinking at 18? I wanted to become a firefighter, a business owner, a priest. I don't know. What were you thinking as 18 years old?
So I started an international business.
Yeah. Okay.
And then when I went, I was trying to still figure it out. Obviously, as freshmen, like you said, we don't know. Like I tell my athletes here all the time, you don't know. You're going to change. You're going to. So I actually went into being a dual major at the Division III route. So I went secondary education because I thought I wanted to get into teaching. And then I was still a business major. So I was business and marketing and secondary education.
I didn't hear you said teacher, but I didn't hear you necessarily say, oh yeah, because I wanted to coach. That's still not even maybe in your purview at this point?
No, I thought if I did end up getting into coaching, it'd probably be a little bit later, and I do high school coaching. Right. That was originally the plan, but really, I really found a love for teaching and making connection with high school. And actually, I wanted to be an inner city high school teacher.
Yeah. Why is that?
I just felt like I made a bigger impact. I felt like I was able to help more. I did inner city kind of like, what is it now? It's not substitute teaching, but like student teaching, right? Mm-hmm. And I just felt like, especially with the athletes, I was able to make a bigger impact and connect with them and really kind of help them as they navigated their college, junior college, secondary options once high school was over with. And that impact and that relationship I was able to build with them during my student teaching and my, helping out with them, I was like, oh, this is something I think I really want to do. And I'd actually feel happy and proud about doing.
Yeah. What did mom and dad, what family do for professions?
So my dad was a lawyer.
Oh, okay.
And then my mom did a lot of stuff. So she worked insurance for a little bit. Then she was an administrative assistant, kind of did a lot of like out-of-end jobs, but always working.
Yeah.
I've got, there's four of us siblings wise. So
Oh, wow.
My older brother is 10 years older than me, so he was kind of like a pseudo parent.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, we're a jack of all trades. My older brother owns his own automotive shop. My dad was a lawyer. My mom was that, and then she was part-time sheriff. And then my little brother works
Whoa,
at.
hold on. You really kind of went right over that one. Did you say mom was a part-time sheriff?
Yeah, for New York
Whoa.
State. Yeah.
Okay. There's a lot of peculiar job, not
Yeah.
normal jobs. Mom was a t hold on. I need to know more about this. Mom was a part-time sheriff. First of all, mom sounds like a badass beyond the sheriff part, but to become a sheriff part-time, full-time, quarter-time doesn't matter. That's amazing. What, how in the world does she become? How does
Yeah.
that happen?
Well, we've got a lot of military and law enforcement stuff in our family, so there always came like a natural respect for that and appreciation for it. And for her growing up, she's a Italian lady, so as you can imagine, she was always kind of like the ruler of the family and the law setter. And so the joke always growing up was, you guys got to stay in line because mom will get you in trouble, and then it's up to dad whether or not he's going to bail you out. So that was a fun dynamic with the sheriff and the lawyer, but yeah, it kept us in line. And yeah, I grew up with a big family, cousins and stuff. So yeah, the mom was always, she's the oldest of 10, so she was always kind of like the law, growing up. So,
Wow.
yeah.
Sounds like you grew up with a pretty good example of hard work. Like you're always going to be working, you're going to be doing something, you're going to be serving other lawyers, serves others. And I tell you, I know there's a lot of lawyer jokes and all that kind of stuff, but man, you can't be a lawyer if you don't know how to read. I mean, they read a lot is what a lot of law stuff is. And then of course, assimilating that into an argument before the judge. But you have that, you have mom who's, the oldest of 10, holy cow, sheriff, things like that. You had a pretty good example of like work is important. You're going to be working.
Oh yeah. I mean, I can remember. So my dad always was up first thing in the morning, last one to bed, first one up. And he opened up his own law firm. I remember he worked for a bigger firm when we were younger. And then when, the four kids got older and we started getting into sports, he opened his own because he was like, listen, I'm gonna work, I'm gonna take you guys to practice, I'm gonna be at your games. But then he'd go and work later at night. And I always just remember that I was like, this guy doesn't have an off switch. Like
Wow.
he was always going, but always doing what he needed to for the family. And the same thing with the mom. My mom was working nonstop to make sure we always had extra things. And then my older brother owned his auto shop. And I remember I'd get up in the morning, I'd go in to work out, I'd run, go to school, go to practice. And then I would either drive or I'd take a bus over to my brother's shop and I'd be helping him with brakes, oil changes, fix up cars, clean up the shop. So I just remember even from a young age, like I'm either working or I'm playing sports and then I'm
Sure.
home sleeping and studying. So it just kind of ingrained in me at a younger age, like, no, you get up and you do it. Like you can complain about it, but nobody's gonna listen to you.
Right. Still got to get it done.
Still gotta get it done. So, I think that helped me, especially when I got into running, because it's like, hey, this isn't easy. This isn't
Right.
gonna come easy, and you gotta work. It's going to be hard, and the harder you work and the more you take, the better you will be. And so I think that helped transcend when I started getting into running, right?
That's cool. I love that you grew up in New York. It just reminds me, we're in the middle of April and May 2024 here when we're recording, and maybe you're listening. Of course, someone's gonna be listening to this in 2030, Nick. So I always have to make sure I stay the dates of where we are. But I found it interesting because we're in the middle of a special state meet series for the podcast. So every day, starting April 2nd all the way through the end of May, one high school coach from each state, and so. Probably right around now, future land, end of April, beginning of May, when this will actually publish, New York will be there because it's right in the middle. In New York, the state meet, that's an interesting thing. Did you qualify for state?
I did.
That's a I was kind of blown away with how New York does the state meet qualifying, who actually goes, how you score, spoiler alert, how you don't score the state meet. It was really interesting, that whole concept of New York.
Yeah, I mean, from sectional to state qualifier to state, and then you have state, and then you have federation, and
Yeah.
it's even changed since I was there, but it's a big process.
It's a big state, of course.
Yeah.
And it sometimes gets lost when we talk about our high school states for that lead population and participation. You always say the big three, Texas, California, and Florida. However, New York's top five. I think it's number four, and I want to say Ohio's number five in regards to participation and things. So it's we I don't know why we forget it because it's up you know, the top right, I guess, but, and it's not sunny, you know, like Texas, et cetera, but man, don't sleep on New York and high school athletes. Quite fascinating. Okay. So you're at Nazareth. I love that you're there. You know, we, I got to go to Rochester for the very first time, I think in 2019, I think is when I went for a site visit for St. John's Fisher for the NCAA Division III. And I popped over to Nazareth because they're hosting indoors, I think next year, I think 2025 is their year. And had never been to Rochester, knew nothing about it. And really was kind of blown away. That's a cool city, man, with the video game and toy hall of fame. Had some of the best, Texas is going to get mad at this, the best wings I've ever had. Dinosaur barbecue, smoked wings. Oh, my God.
Yeah,
that was a cool place. Like, I was like, oh, I got to come back. I got to bring the family here for the Hall of Fame. So that was a cool place. So what was it like at Nazareth? Seems like a, you know, been on campus. Seems like a cool little campus there. And being a dual sport athlete, how'd that go?
Yeah. So they didn't have the indoor track when I was there, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say that's pretty new. Right. Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So they, I'm jealous of them for that, but sure. I love it. I was actually on the committee, the student athlete committee for bringing an indoor track back in 2006, and then they didn't, they got it a couple of years back, but I, you know, was kind of on one of those initial like talks about why to bring it there. But no, I loved it. It was, what I liked about it is I obviously knew the track coach, right? And then I was able to play soccer, and it was a smaller community, but I had a lot of friends in that area growing up, obviously in Syracuse, you know, only an hour and a half. So I had a lot of friends in the Rochester area. But what you don't really realize is like I had high school friends that were at St. John Fisher, at Geneseo, at Brockport, at RIT, and then I was at Nazareth. So what was really cool for me is within a 20 to 30 minute drive, I had a lot of friends and they went to other colleges. So to me, it was like, okay, I'm going to the smaller school, but it felt like the extension of a larger field because I had all these friends at different places, and I really enjoyed the community and the atmosphere. So to me, it kind of felt more homey. So, yeah, so it was really, really nice. And I felt, you know, from an academic standpoint all the way to an athletic standpoint, it was very individualized. I had a great rapport with my college professors, and, you know, I had family. I had aunts and uncles and cousins who were in Rochester. So, you know, if I needed a home cooked meal or get away from home, I drove over and saw them. So to me, it was really good for me to kind of grow up in that time and have a lot of support around me.
Did you play both sports all 4 years?
So I only did it my sophomore year there. I started for the soccer program. We made the NCAA championships, played there. And then I have a funny story on how track fully took over for me.
Yeah, yeah. That's what we're here for. All the funny stories.
So sophomore year, I finished third in the 800 meters at the NCAA outdoor championships.
Wow.
And you probably remember Nick Simmons and Will Lear.
Of course.
So they might remember this, but I, you know, I kept in touch with them a couple of years past. Haven't really talked to Nick or Will in a while, but they were always really, really, really nice guys. Really supportive of the Division III track athletes. And I love that about them. So here I am as a sophomore, really still kind of a youngin. And I was still kind of naive to it. Like I love when runners are naive because you know, other competitors, but I always tell athletes like just toe the line and any given day, anyone can beat anybody. Right. Mm-hmm. Especially in the 800, the 800's crazy race. It's, you know, so Nick always did the 15-8 double. And I remember I'd go back and watch film and watch videos. I'm like, man, they just give it to this guy. He's so good. They let him jog around in the 15, sit and kick and win. And then the 800, they let him sit and they let him just kick and win.
Right.
And I was like, I turned to my coach and I'll never forget this. And I was a sophomore. I go, I'm going to give it to him. I'm going to take it out for 600 meters and I'm going to try to hold on, but I'm going to make him run.
All right.
And so I remember I took it out. It was like 50 point, maybe 51.
Is this at Nationals?
At Nationals.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
And we're at, I think it's Benedict or Benedictine College there in Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it's like 108, 109 on the track. It's a hot day. And so I just watched him jog around for the 15 and, you know, they like kind of rolled over and gave it to him. And I was like, man, I'm going to make this guy run. So I took it out. I just went. And I was leading until like 60 or 70 meters to go. And then him and another guy, Jeff Zoda, passed me. And I ended up getting third, but I remember them, they went by. I finish, I get third. We're in the tent. So after you finish nationals, they bring you over to the tent. They're like, top eight, go wait for your All-American awards, get up on the stand. And I remember it gave me the biggest smile on my face. It looked like absolute carnage in the tent. Every guy's just laid out. And I remember Nick's like hand on knees, like huffing, puffing. And for viewer discretion, I won't say exact, but he said, who the blank took that out? Right. And so I'm at the end of the tent, and I remember I hear Nick go, "Who the blank took that out?" And I just look down, I raise my hand, and he looks at me, goes, "You and me cooling down after awards." And
Wow.
I'm like, "Oh man!" So I go for a cool down with Nick Simmons and Will Lear,
Oh, dude.
and Nick goes, "How come I don't see you in the fall? What are you doing?" I was like, "I'm a soccer player." And he looked at me and he goes, "Not anymore. You're running cross country. You're a runner."
Wow. That's did you know Nick was a D3 legend in at that time, like actively as an athlete. Like, you know, like you said, he won a lot of races and was, you know, I don't want to say necessarily far superior, but you know, was obviously very, very talented. And then he, you know, goes on to become, you know, bigger than life in regards to, you know, Olympics and things like that. And Will Lear, gosh bless. But that's so it's hard to see it in the moment. You know he's really good, but like you don't know necessarily right there. It's like, oh, you know, this guy's gonna end up setting this and doing that and making this team, et cetera. That you look back on that now, that was pretty cool and pretty, I think I can say this on the podcast, pretty ballsy on your point of like, hey, I'm just whatever's gonna happen is gonna happen, but I certainly am not gonna sit back and just give it to the guy, let the guy have it.
Yeah, he's gonna beat me if I let him have his race. So I'm gonna make him earn it. And I've got this really cool picture. I have it saved in kind of my memory. I don't have it here. I have it at home. But he turned around, and the best thing was, like, after he won, he turned around and gave me this hug, and somebody took a capture of that. And here we are finishing. Everybody, like, you just look and there's people laid out on the track. But I was like, man, that was really cool for him to all of a sudden just take time out of his, pull aside and have a conversation with me. And
So
yeah.
it's one thing for, you know, he's a stranger still, but it's one thing for a stranger, even a good stranger in your sport, to say, hey, you're not doing soccer anymore. You're running cross country. Did you heed that advice?
Oh yeah. So then I was like, I'm done. Like, cool. Here's a guy who's at that time, he won nationals in the 8 and 15, at 3 of his 4 years. I think the
Right.
1 year he had a slight injury, so he didn't run the 15, but like, this is like a multi-time, national champion. And he walks up to me and just, I was like, yeah, I'm gonna take this in. Okay. And I loved it. And at that point, obviously we, it's always more fun to win. Like we tell our athletes that it's fun winning. So here I am, third, and first, second, and fourth are seniors. And here's the seniors, multi-time All-American, national champion coming up. And I was like, you know what? Yeah, okay, fine. I'm gonna go all in on it. And that's when I made that kind of transition.
And then your first race was a 10K. So that fall, you took the advice, you go to fall, you do the mileage, you're not doing soccer, which you know you had a long time love for and passion for. And then the first race is a 10K and you get done and you're like, can I still go to the soccer team? Is that still
I
open
would
for
be,
me?
yes, it my love for cross country did not come right away. That's for sure.
Was it okay? That's good. I was gonna ask, did it like automatically, or you were like, you know, soccer's not that bad. I can hop over there still.
No, and I think I had a really bad first 10K experience. So we went up to my college used to go up to, because that's when it was easier to go to Canada and race. We
Right.
just made a little drive over. So we went to Western Ontario, ran a 10K. And as you know, like Canadians and Europeans and all this, they're used to like kilometers, right? And even distance runners, like even now I talk and 1K to go, 2K to go, 3K, that 10K race, this is why it's still probably really ingrained in my brain as like an awful experience. I went up and ran the 10K, and it was a 5K loop. You did it twice. And came through 5K, and I was like, okay, it's not as bad, but I'm hurting. And then I was with this group of runners, and their coach goes, two to go, you gotta go now. And in my head as a track guy, I'm like, oh, two to go. So I took off.
You thought 2K to go.
I thought it was 200 to go.
Oh no.
It was 2K. So I'm sprinting and I'm going for like 400 meters. And my coach was there at the mile marker to go. So here I go from 2K to 1600 to go. And I'm gassed. And he looks at me and he's like, what are you doing? I think I ran like a 7:20, 7:30 last mile because I just gassed it. And so
Oh,
I finish a 10K and
Nick.
I'm gone.
You
Yeah.
did the I didn't count my laps correctly, and so on the seventh lap of the eight lap race, I'm kicking it, and it's like, oh bro, you still got another lap. You had another mile. Oh man.
So that's my first ever cross country experience, and I think my love for it was like, oh.
How does that feel? Yeah, we've seen that, and as an observer, if you've never done it, you feel bad. Sometimes there's judgment of like, well, you should have counted laps, or you should have known, he meant 2K or whatever, all these kind of things. But so you have the experience. You're running well. You're obviously accomplished. You're third at Nationals in the 800 the spring before you. So you're an accomplisher. You're not some rookie, first time running track or first time running cross country, even things like that. You're running well. You finish that first lap of 5K feeling okay. I'm not feeling too bad. You have something left to kick, so you kick, and then you have a mile that has to feel like you are running in cold molasses, and there has to be a little bit of a helpless feeling of like, well, I can't not finish, but oh my, I'm not able to run anywhere near what I want to and can be running right now. How does that feel? How in the moment when you're just there's no one can help you. This is the great thing and the maybe not so great thing about cross country and track. No one can help you. Your teammate can't come grab you, and there's no substitutions. You've got to finish this mile. And you said you run it in 7 minutes, which is pedestrian for an athlete at your level. How does that feel?
Yeah. So the best way to describe it, like I've tried to explain it, because I tell this story to a lot of my athletes all the time and kind of joke about it. My coach, even in the moment, instead of getting mad, he laughed about it. That's where I think that enjoyable kind of background for me comes. He was like, oh, well, that was a mistake. Right. And the best way to describe it, because I think we can all relate in track and field. Imagine doing a full lactic workout where you just laid out, you're doing a full sprint, you cross the line, and your body, your legs, you just shut down. The elephant jumped on your back and you got the last 50 meters and you're like, I don't know if I can pick up my legs. It felt like I did that. And then instead of laying on the ground, which you want to do, they were like, okay, go for your cool down right away. And you know, those cool downs, you just can't get moving and your legs shut down. That's how it felt. I was like, I'm already shot. I'm dead. My legs are gone. And here I still got to jog a mile, like, or race a mile, but I'm jogging. Like because I think at that point, like, I want to say we came through on grass, right? And this is early September. We came through like 1540, 1545. And I was pretty good. And I was through it through 8K right on pace. And the winners and all the guys I was around ended up running, low 31s on grass, which back then, was pretty good.
Yeah.
I think I ran like 33, right? Because they put 2 minutes on me in the last mile.
Right.
And I just remember just everyone just going by and too, just seeing like waves of people just go by me. And I was just, I couldn't even respond. So I think the only thing in my head was like, just stay up. Just don't go down. You got to finish for your team, right?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
obviously there's still a team score and everything else. So that helped me get through, but I just couldn't respond.
That's what I love about it is, the attitude of I have to do it for my team. We see, I haven't seen this much lately, and maybe I'm just not paying attention to it much, but I remember when I was coaching, we'd see 10K, 5K races, and, a guy would be having a bad race and would step off the track. And it was always like, man, if you do that once, it's really easy to do it the second time and the third time. And maybe in track, it's a little air quotes here easier because the team aspect, team scoring isn't as prevalent as in cross country. Certainly we have conference and nationals and things like that, but at a normal Alabama Crimson Tide, there is no school team score. So it's easy for me to hop off. I don't negatively affect my team. But you kept at it. If I'm going to run 20 minutes for this mile, it's going to be completed. It's not going to be shut down because of my mistake. Yeah. Oh man. That's amazing. How did you mentally prepare for the next race? So that was the first race of the season. There's a few more to go. How did you make sure like, okay, this is not going to happen again?
Well, I think in track, it's just so easy to kind of know where you're at. And so in cross country, then what I started trying to teach myself is, okay, give yourself markers or placements or visual cues. So I started realizing, okay, when I make this turn or when I pass this tree or this building or this is how far out I am. So it gave me a better way to kind of visually prepare for cross country, right? And give myself cues and markers. It was kind of like a learning experience right away, full on the go, and then how to mentally prepare for cross country different than track.
I love turning it into a lesson. I feel like that's probably been something that's that mistake has probably benefited you 100 times over, not only as an athlete, but as a coach of preparation for future races.
Yeah. And now I go back even with my team now, because when I go and mark out courses and we have certain areas and certain cues, I'm like, okay, hey, this is how we're breaking up your race. This is how we're segmenting it. Because every athlete has a different race plan, different tactic, different. I try to give them visual cues along with the verbal, right? But I'm like, okay, hey, when we come into this fight, because sometimes I even tell them I might not make it there. If you guys start getting spread out and then I've got this girl here. So I try telling them, I'm going to try to make it to this mark and you're going to hear this. But when you hit this point in the race and you hit this straightaway, this turn, this is when you got to make this decision. Right. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not there, you've got to do it.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
So that's helped me. Yeah.
I know we all grow up, you know, our track athletes today and cross country athletes today grow up wanting to be a Crimson Tide, an SEC athlete running for you and Dan and the group there. But you seem to have had a really good Division III experience. I mean, you talk about, you were at the championships tournament for soccer. You're at the national meet. You're placing at the national meet. That seemed like that's a pretty good college experience for you.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Yeah, I did. I did. I loved it. I think it fit me. I don't know. You know, sometimes you go back and you're like, oh man, what a big Division One. You know, I don't know, because it kept my love for it. And I ran a little bit post-collegiately. And I think that's what got me into coaching, right? And it helped expand my career. Because when I started, I was a 400, 800 guy.
Right.
And then I moved up and then I was more 15 and then I was 15, 5K. And then so I got to have the range of it. And I think being a Division III athlete, I think having the soccer. So now when I coach from middle distance to 10K, I really feel like I'm a versatile coach, you know, just like I was as an athlete. So it helped me grow, because I remember even in college running, you know, I graduated college in the highest mileage week that I ever had, I think was like 46 miles.
Wow.
And then as a post-collegiate, I got up to running 85 to 90.
Wow.
So I know how to coach athletes cross training. I know how to coach them at 25, 30 miles a week. I know how to coach them at high mileage and everywhere in between, because I did it. Mm-hmm. Right. So I now apply that now even in my coaching, even in my team, like my 5K runners, I've got some girls cross training a lot, running 35 miles a week, you know, based on their, you know, history and what they're capable and what they can handle. And then I've got some running 80, 85. So I coach them everywhere in between.
And I want to touch on that. But before we touch on that specific topic, so you mentioned post-collegiately, and then that's how you got into coaching. So give us that story. How did you actually get into coaching?
Yeah, so at the time, one of my 800-meter friends, Kenny Jasinski, he ran at Florida State. He started running post-collegially for Kevin Sullivan, who's now the director at University of Michigan. So he called me up and I still wanted to run a little post-collegiate. He's like, hey, we got a small group down here. You know, there's 3-4 guys, you know, running the 800, 1500. Why don't you come down here for the summer, run with us, kind of see what it's about. And if you like it, you know, move down here and train with us. So I went down, stayed with Kenny for about 2-3 weeks, ran with them, met Kevin. Kevin's like, yeah, hey, if you want to make a go at this, I'll coach you. And I was like, oh my gosh, here's a, you know, 4-time Olympian, amazing guy, really, really, you know, personable. I was like, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. So I'm going to go down. I'm going to just run. I worked, I wasn't in grad school, didn't do anything at the time. I was just like, I'm just going to go down and run and take this in while I can. You know, I'm still young at the time. I graduated at 21.
Oh, wow.
So here, all these athletes have, you know, 23, 24, 25 years old at the time. I remember, was it David McNeil at NAU is still 25 and running,
yeah,
you know,
wow.
And I'm like, man, I still have my best years ahead of me. So I'm going to give it a go. And so I went down there, ran for Coach Sullivan, ran with the group. And then we were training down at Florida State because Kevin was down there at the time. And one of the graduate assistants at Florida State left mid-year to take a job. And I was in my running and I was still around, and Coach Bob Brayman kind of pulled me aside. He goes, hey, you're running, you know, the guys seem to like you, you're in the area. What if you come and be a graduate assistant, go to grad school, you know, start that route, and then help me out when you can. And you can use the facilities, obviously, as a GA, and you can still keep your training career. And then you just help me. You drive a van occasionally when I need. And so I was like, okay, that sounds like a really cool idea. Like,
right.
I'll do this. And then Unfortunately enough, but fortunately enough for my collegiate career, I actually partially tore my plantar that outdoor season. So I ran really, really fast, and then I had a slight tear in it, and ended up, that kind of cycle, it really disrupted my running career. And so now here I am hurt, and I'm like, okay, what am I going to do? Well, I just went full into the GA mode, the graduate assistant role with the Florida State men. So I'm hanging out with the guys more. I'm driving them places. I'm helping Coach Brayman. He's doing the coaching and stuff, but I'm just kind of there and helping out. And the guys really gravitated towards me. I had a good relationship, good rapport with them. And I found this other love of it, watching them succeed and talking to them. And they were always coming to me and just talking to me about personal advice. Coach Brayman did the coaching, but then I found like Coach Brayman's like, hey, walk them through this, or hey, give me a guy to kind of mentor or get. And he started kind of nudging me that way without really seeing it. I kind of took on this other role. And that's when in my head I was like, man, I think I might like this side of it too. So I didn't really consider college coaching or even coaching full time until I had that graduate assistant position.
Quite interesting, and definitely a great mentor to have in Bob Brayman. Love Bob, and he was an amazing guy. And I love that a lot of us think that when we get into coaching, whether it's specifically college coaching or not, that it's like this, all-consuming passion. I had a coach and I wanted to be like them, but most of the time it's like it's a slow burn. It's less of a light switch of like, oh, one day it's like, boom, I'm going to be a coach, and more of that fader button. And it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll do this GA thing. Sure, I'm hurt. I need something to do. I'll become a grad assistant. I'm not necessarily going to be a college coach, but I'll be a grad assistant. And then you find yourself, the slider button goes up a little bit more. It's like, oh, I kind of like, watching these workouts, and oh, these guys, it's running and off the track stuff that helps affect your running positively or negatively. And those guys seem to like to talk to me about it, and I can help. The fader button goes up a little bit more, and it's like, oh man, now I like running my own group. That's really, I like that slow burn, because it helps people to see a path towards this one day. A lot of people think they want to be in college coaching. A lot of people think that they cannot ever make it into college coaching. So to see that that it can be a process to get there is a really good example for others that are out there. So I like that. So how'd that keep going? You're GA, you're GA at Florida State. I was born in Florida, and I grew up a huge Florida State fan. So anytime Florida State's mentioned, I feel good about my roots there. And you're with Bob Brayman and other great. I mean, he's always had an amazing staff around him as well, by the way. I don't know what it is, but he certainly seems to attract really good men and women to be coaches and athletes for him there. How'd that continue as you went down your GA route?
Yeah, so I met a lot of great coaches there. Coach Metters, who's back there now. Coach Ken Harden, who's now at Auburn. I see him all the time. So he was back there. I mean, this was Florida State, like really good days, right? Like I got to see some amazing track and field. I'm spoiled in that regard.
Yeah.
I walk out there, and at that time he just turned post-collegiate, but like Walter Dix was out there, and then you had the Borley twins, and you had it
Right.
was just arranged. And then Michael Cherry was there before he went to LSU. And so you have them, and then you have the cross country team, which then goes the next year and gets second at NCAA Nationals when I was there. So I see like the cross country team succeeding. One of my good friends at the time too, Mike Fout, was on the team. So like you had distance to sprints to jumps to relays to throwers, like, and to me, I was just like taking it. I was like, whoa, okay, this was the D1 experience that maybe I missed out, but I was like, I get the best of both. I had my D3 experience, now I get my D1 experience, and I got to see the whole range, right? So yeah, I was there doing that, trying to figure out kind of my next step. And then when I finished up running with Coach Sullivan, I then started running for a post-collegiate group, Stoughton Racing, which was like John and Bill Aris up in Syracuse, Fayetteville, New York. I ran for them as kind of like a satellite guy. So I still wanted to get into coaching, still trying to figure out things. So I moved back home for a little bit. And it's funny you mentioned St. John Fisher. So I went there and I was the recruiting coordinator for a year. So I lived up in the area, was still kind of running, ran for Stoughton Racing at the time. And then I was just became like a full-time recruiter. I didn't have a coaching responsibility. I just recruited for St. John Fisher. Yeah.
Yeah,
And
I like that. Sorry to interrupt.
no, you're good.
Because I love busting myths. And one of the myths out there is if you are a GA for a Florida State, a Bob Braman, or a Texas, UCLA, whatever, quote unquote big name school, oh, you're getting the next job. It's automatic. Nick's, you're the GA of Florida State. You're certainly getting the assistant's job at Auburn or South Carolina, whatever, right? I love that. It's like, oh, yeah, no, I went back and became a recruiting coordinator for St. John's Fisher. Like, it's part of, again, really important in this podcast that people hear others' journeys because there's a lot of misconceptions of it's easy to look on the other side and think, oh, Nick's at Alabama because he was the GA of Florida State. And it's like, oh, we're about to find out. There's a route to get there that takes hard work, time, experience, dedication, networking for sure, coaching excellence, those are all, it all culminates to get to where you are today. It's not an automatic, oh, I was a GA at Florida State, so I automatically get the Alabama job. So I love this stacking of your journey. So you're at St. John's Fisher, you're back home. Home seems to be a, I know you're at Alabama now, but home seems to have a pull, right? Coastal Carolina, back close to home. You really made a point about when you're there at Nazareth that it felt home because you had friends at this school at RIT and at Genesee, so home and friends seem to be a kind of a theme for you, that that's an important stabilizer for you.
Yeah, it was a big comfort. I think, especially with what we do, to me, it's enjoying where you're at and what you're doing, and having a good support system around you is really beneficial. And I did miss an important segment there too, like in between. So I did two stints as a GA at Florida State, and in between the two, I was actually a volunteer for a year. So I went, was with Kevin Sullivan, was a graduate assistant, and then I left, and I was actually a volunteer at the University of Connecticut under Andrea Grove McDonough, who I just worked with at Toledo before here. So
Okay, right.
we'll get this long. But so I went with her for 1 year, and it was that last year she was there before she went to Iowa State. But it was when she took that team and really they got onto the national scene. So I got to see this transition of like the back end of her working really hard and getting this team who never qualified for NCAAs, build them up. And then I went and helped her for a year. And helped out with the women's team, was a volunteer, and then she took the Iowa State job. So here I am back in this like flux of like, okay, well, I'm a volunteer, so I don't have this paid position. She just left. And I still needed to finish my graduate work, believe it or not, because long story short, I didn't end up finishing. I thought I finished, but then I got this call that I missed one important class that you can only take in person. And so here I am. I leave, think I finished my master's degree, think I'm graduating, and I'm a volunteer now up at UConn, and Florida State calls me and says, "No, your advisor missed something. You're one class shy."
Dude.
So it kind of lined up because Andrea leaves, and then I needed this class, and Coach Braman and I are still talking, and he's like, "Funny enough, we just lost another graduate assistant, mid-year who took a job." He goes, "Why don't you come back and finish it?" So I went back to Florida State. Finished up that year with Coach Braman again, one more year, and then I took the St. John Fisher job.
That's so fun. I mean, you're a little bit like a, sometimes these kind of roles are diminished, but you're the Swiss Army knife. It's like, oh man, I need somebody for a semester. Who am I going to get for a semester? Oh, thank God Nick needs a class and can come back. You know what I'm saying? It's extremely valuable. It's all part of the puzzle to put together a program. So that's really good and valuable that you had that skill set and that need. What was this one class that you had to take?
Oh my gosh. To be honest, I can't even remember, but I was
Exactly.
like, I could have done this
Exactly,
remotely. Like,
exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking.
no, it was fun because I went back, and so that helped me. And then what was good is it exposed me back to the ACC and back with Coach Braman, and it expanded my role when I went back the second time too, because I was a little bit older with it. And then Coach Braman had something with like his hamstring, his back. I can't remember what he did, but he had an injury then. So it stepped me into a little bit of a larger role than I had before. And so that kind of helped evolve my coaching career a little bit faster. And then, yeah, and then I was applying for jobs. I was looking, nothing really was biting. And here I am. And I'm like, okay, I was a volunteer with Andrea. I was back at Florida State. And then this recruiting coordinator position opened up, and it was near family, and it was an area I knew. So I took it.
So how was that? Because, you know, we think of recruiting coordinators as a very D1 type of thing. Here, you're a recruiting coordinator for a Division III school. What was the learning process? What were some of the tasks that you were tasked with? And then, and what learning did you have to do to actually become good at it?
Well, I think I'm a very social guy anyways, right? And I loved going to track meets, and it almost felt like you're an admissions counselor at the Division III level, right? Because them, it's about numbers and a couple other, you know, just assets of like holding, you know, big recruiting weekends or going out to high schools and watching a lot of meets. So they're like, listen, you just got to recruit, bring numbers in. Obviously, we want some talented kids, but we want numbers, and, you know, we're big on bringing kids in and then retaining them. So I turned into a supportive role, right? And for me, I was like, okay, well, I can still keep running. I'm recruiting, I'm going to meets, I'm doing whatever. So it gave me a lot of flexibility with what I needed to do. And, you know, I've got a 9-year-old now, so he was just born right around then. So it allowed me to be a full-time dad, get paid in a position, still kind of run, still do it. So it allowed me to kind of find, you know, that next step for me. And it gave me a lot of that flexibility. And Coach Mike Henschen, who was there, who just recently retired, you know, he stepped into a different role there, but, it gave me a different view on coaching. And I kind of evolved down to like, okay, my recruiting tactics, or learning a little bit more on like a full program. Cause obviously Florida State operates, I mean, you've got everybody in every position, everything. And now you're going to a Division III school, back to what I was. And I got to see the other side of what maybe my coach dealt with. And okay, now here's a smaller staff. Here's many hats you have to wear. Here's different things you have to. So I liked it because I got to see both ends.
You're certainly busy. You know, you're running yourself. You're recruiting. You got a job. You're a recruiting coordinator for the for St. John's Fisher. And you're a father, that alone right there, right? Did you have time to miss the actual coaching component to it or not?
I don't know. At that moment, I think it, I was still kind of, I would say the best thing is I was aware of what I was. So like, even now, like I tell people, like, I don't have the ambition just yet to be a director. Right. I love being a distance coach. I love having my group. I love coaching the women here. But I know that comes with learning and comes with experience, and that comes with time. Right. At that time, I know what I know and I know what I don't know. And at that point in my career, I was like, I could be a distance coach, but I'd rather, when I step into a full-time distance role, when I have a program, I want to feel like I'm excelled at it, right? Mm-hmm. I want to feel like I'm a little bit more knowledge. I have a little bit more better grasp of it. So even at that time, I was still more aware of, there's still things I need to learn if I want to be good, because let's face it, even being in Alabama, I wouldn't be here if I wasn't competitive and I wasn't good at what I did, and I didn't find ways every single year to be a better coach, a better person, a better father. Every aspect of my life, I'm always like, how can I be better? So at that point, I think even in a coaching realm, I didn't miss it because I still needed to learn more, right? I was still, things that every day, every season, every week, I was learning how to be a better coach for. So I was still taking in, like, even when I was at Florida State, they joke about it, because I even do it here at Alabama. I go around and I just watch and listen to the sprints practice, the jumps practice, the throws practice. I listen to Coach Waters, who's been here for years and had amazing success at, you know, the different levels and different programs he's at. But I'm always trying to find ways to learn and implement it into my distance coaching. And that doesn't come from just distance workouts or distance running. Like, I listen to the way they communicate with their athletes. I listen to the way they give cues. I listen to the motivational aspect, like Coach Yush, Coach Pate, Coach Wiley. Like, we have some, Coach Gibson, even Coach Duckworth, who's, you know, younger, and Coach. I learn from every coach on our staff here how to be a better human, how to be a better coach, how to be a better, and I think it can apply to every event in track and field. So yeah, that's what I was doing at the Division III level. I was like, how can I be a better coach? I'm just going to soak it in and fit it in with my personality and my style to, you know, my athletes.
How do you balance? It's interesting to hear you say that, because on the other side of the coin, in today's 2024 coaching world of, be the head coach, be the man or the woman in charge. If you're 25, you should already be looking for a head coaching job, and you're deploying massive amounts of patience through that. Like, one side, the hustler grind, get to the extreme top today. Mentality would be like, hey, Nick, what do you mean you don't want to be a director right now? What's wrong with you? Why aren't you charging forward and trying to, the next head job that comes open? Why aren't you applying for it? And yada yada. And you're kind of, I'm hearing you set up with patience for a long, successful career, not a get into it and learn it on the job, which you're still going to have no matter what. You never know the job until you're in the job. But I'm hearing really massive amounts of patience for you.
Oh yeah, like I, because when I do things, I want to do it right, right? Like Alabama came in at the right time, Toledo came in the right time for me when I was there. But I hope you can see if you look through my career, is like when I have gone places, it in a shorter amount of time, meaning shorter, like 2, 3 years, got it to a point where it has either been successful or has. And I think that's because I took the time to learn and apply it and grow with it, that when I make that transition or that step, it's at the right time, or I try to do it the right way. We're not always going to be perfect. Like, no one is perfect. No coach is perfect. No program's perfect. But you can do it the right way, and you can do it a certain regard that fits you. And so for me, like, I'm in the place I need to be and the place I want to be, and doing it a successful way because of the stops that I've had and because of the lessons I've had. And yeah, so like even in this moment, like you were saying, like I think just being here and having the patience and understanding this is where I want to get, I can see a bigger goal, a bigger picture, a bigger view, and have that aim. And through my experiences, I know certain steps that I have to check off before I get there. I just can't go from A to Y and expect Z, right? It takes all these times. So if I can do A through G, which I know, and then continue to build it, which is what we're doing here, I've known those stops. And yeah, as a younger age, a lot of us want that. Like, oh, we're all about having that big time, that big result, that big. But I think if you skip over some of those key steps and you just put yourself in, it can lead to a harder fall or a bigger disaster. Because you can take that job, and if we're not ready for it, if we don't have the foundation, if we don't, you might have a short amount of window. And I tell this even with athletes, right? There's certain things we can do as athletes to get immediate success. But then the downfall from that, or the repercussions or the consequences, could be really hard, right? Look, we jump our mileage really high, right? We go from 30 miles a week to 90 miles a week. You could all of a sudden have a race or two that all of a sudden it's like a big breakthrough. But then do you get hurt? Do you burn out? Do we overdo it? Does something disastrous happen that's now so detrimental that it ruins your career or ruins the season? Or so it. If you miss all those middle steps, even as a coach, you can have short success, but it's not going to be long. I'm trying to build long-term success.
I love how you connected that. And if you're listening, hit the rewind button here a little bit and go back and listen. I love how, Nick, how you connected the dots all the way. Cause I was going to ask that question. I was going to help bridge that, but you bridged it for me of, okay, here's what I'm doing in my career. What I'm really doing is I'm slowing down to speed up, by the way, is exactly what Nick was describing there. And then my connection question was going to be, okay, so how do you implement that in coaching? And you did, thank God you did it, because you could have did the opposite. Well, my athletes, it's different though, because I only got four, but you're like, oh no, we've got to make sure we're putting the plan together correctly and building, the proverbial distance coaching, right? Building on that base to get to the successes that we want on the track for a 5K, 10K, mile, whatever you might be, your target race might be. So go back and listen. That's a really important thing that he's describing here for your career. We have a lot of athletes that listen to the podcast now as well. Your career as an athlete, but mainly for our coaches out there, this is not an edict of don't have ambition. This is a lesson in preparation so that when you get to those jobs, when you get those opportunities, when you earn those opportunities, you have more success faster. And therefore, you're leading your athletes faster, to have more success there. So I really love that attitude really that you have of your career and how you're continuing to develop it. Okay, so you're at Division III St. John's Fisher as a recruiting coordinator. You keep hinting and mentioning Toledo. Is that what's next? Do we go from there to Toledo? What's next after St. John's Fisher's?
Then I'm at Duke University.
Oh, okay. Of course. I knew, you know what? I just like, we're not going to go straight to Toledo. There's something else. All right. So you go to Duke. What, where, why, how did you get to Duke?
Man. So I'm there for 2.5 years under coach Norm Ogilvie.
Yeah. Great Norm.
So they had a runner back in the day there, Sean Thompson. He was an upstate New York guy as well. He was a 5K, 10K runner for Duke, but he grew up 10, 15 minutes from where I grew up. He knew of me. I worked at a couple running camps, you know, he was younger. And I remember Sean and I were talking on the phone and I was still kind of getting into coaching, still working out. And I talked to Sean one summer and I was like, man, I'm trying to get back into Division I. I'm trying to, but nobody's biting. Nobody's bringing me along. And he goes, well, we just lost our volunteer. Like, we need a volunteer coach. Why don't you call Coach Norm? And
Nick, you got some kind of like a North Star towards when someone loses someone. It's like, all right, I'm in. You're the greatest tag team partner in the world. It's like, oh, my guy's gone. All right, tag Nick. Let's get in here.
Yeah. And I'll never forget. So I called Coach Ogilvie like out of the blue. So Sean gives me his number. I send him a text, call him up, and I call Coach. And I'm like, hey, Coach, I want to come coach for you. I know you just had a position. I want to come fill it. And I remember his first thing is like, we don't have a paid position. Like, and I'm not hiring right now. I'm like, Coach, no. I want to volunteer for you.
Wow.
And he was like, oh, like it completely changed. He went from like, I'm not hiring you. Like what? And then obviously he's like, oh, wait, you want to volunteer? Like, cool. Like when can you start? You know, at that time, so then I end up, okay, I'm going to go volunteer at Duke. Like, this is an awesome opportunity to get my feet back in Division I, expand my networking. And so I worked at a running shop as much as I could to make, you know, ends meet, and then helped with, you know, Duke, with the men's side. And I did that for 2.5 years, still trying to find my way, you know, waiting for paid position, doing all this. So it was a long roundabout way to get into coaching. And then I actually took an NAIA job from Duke.
What? I'm always interested in this because I actually, yeah, I've been very public about this. I actually don't like this route that you're taking. And here's why.
Yeah.
How are you? You mentioned the running shop. You're a father. Even if you weren't a father at this point, you're a human being. You're 25, 26-ish. You're in that range, you know, if I got my age group right here. You know, there's life. There's, you know, the rent. There's car payment. There's insurance, you know, passions, charities. You know, there's all these things that you could and should be doing. That take money. You know, we like to make money this big evil thing. And it's like, sorry, it's how we do anything around here. So it's not a shame for a track coach to make money. I really dislike when I hear I do it for the kids. And that's awesome. That's great.
Yeah.
So do teachers. You need to get paid for this. So the reason I say I don't like this is I don't like volunteer coaches. I think you should be paid. I think we should have, you know, football gets what, you know, 100 coaches. I think they're allowed technically to get paid. I think track should be able to hire 20 coaches. Because one of the questions, if we get time here, you know, in the Alabama system, there are several distance coaches that you have there. And I'm always curious, you know, a sprint coach will look back and be like, well, why is there 5 distance coaches? I only, you know, won for all these events. And I look at it like, oh yeah, sprint coach, you should have 4 assistant or what, you know, I think there should be more. So I really don't like this system, but because I think you should be getting paid. But in the heat, maybe not in the heat of the moment, let's use perspective. In perspective, is it worth it? I mean, you're struggling. You probably are struggling. You're hustling for sure, but you're not getting paid what you're worth to do what you are good at and want to do. And that's coaching cross country and track and field.
Yeah, I will say I probably had some opportunities. I just knew kind of what I was looking for in the moment. And I think over years, I evolved and kind of looked at it in a different scope. Like, I made my network, I made my connections. And I think every stop I did helped me to get to where I am right now.
Certainly.
I could have taken certain positions to go a certain way and I turned them away that probably would have made life financially easier. But it goes back to, you know, what I was saying earlier on understanding sometimes there's a process in there. I knew my end goal, right? Like I'm in my dream position right now. My experiences, certain things along the way have helped set me up to be successful here and to get this job. So in that regard, I'm not like, okay, I should have maybe done it different. Yeah, I probably could have made life a little easier, but I also knew in order to be successful, it wasn't going to come easy, right? It goes back to being a successful runner. And so, no, I wish I was paid, but in the moment, like I think there are so many valuable lessons that I learned being a part-time, being a volunteer, when I got my full-time position, working NAIA, working Division III, that now have made me a better coach and a better human being for where I am today. It would have helped, but I don't regret it.
So let's speed up a little bit for time reasons, because I want to explore this with you. I think you and I can have a good conversation about this and have some disagreements and agreements that will help the greater coaching body, because you're in a position now as a coach at the University of Alabama and the age and stage that you're at. And certainly you're not facing retirement, so it's not like you have that much experience in relationship to some other coaches that we've had here, but you are certainly kind of in the muck of it right now and coming out of the muck of it. So I want to have that conversation. So let's speed up here just a little bit. So you go to Duke, 2.5 years, I think you said, volunteer coach. Where next after that?
Then I take a position at Ottawa University
When the heck do we get to Toledo? Okay, so Ottawa in Kansas.
in Kansas.
Yep, I know it well. Yep. Okay. All right. So you go to Ottawa.
I was there about 3 years, NAIA. It was near my ex's in-laws, so it was more of a family move,
Got
right?
it.
And
Yeah. Paid position.
paid position.
Congratulations. I'm happy for you. Okay, good, good, good.
Thank you. So full-time position. A bit of a family move.
And Ottawa is NAIA, if I remember correctly. Yep, you said that already. Sorry. So this is important because I always like to, or I really like to try to squish down NCAA Division One, and really, to me, Division One is two different divisions. There's the, formerly now Power Five. No one's formally called it the Power Four yet. I got to start coining that term, the Power Four, and then the rest of Division One. As a guy who graduated from Troy University, trust me, it's Troy is not competing against University of Alabama. I'm sorry, but we're not. Alabama has a shot at winning the national title. Troy doesn't. And no, yeah, my son's name is Troy, so no one's a bigger Troy fan than I am. I'm not slamming Troy. It's the economics of where we are in this society. So I try to squish NCAA Division One, Power Four, and NAIA JUCO together. Meaning, if you're truly in it for the kids, and I think every coach would say that, and I believe every coach believes that, then to me, it does not matter if you're coaching at Paducah High School in Kentucky or if you're coaching at University of Alabama. Just because your kids run faster, because you get them naturally. They come to you faster than what Paducah is getting when he first starts coaching, he or she starts coaching, right? That does not matter to me. How good the athletes are, I could care less. I'm happy when you guys win cross country and things like that. That's cool, but I don't care. It doesn't make you more valuable or less valuable to me. So I'm curious. You talked about, you're at your dream job now. You were at UConn. That's a big school. You're at Duke. That's a big school as far as, stature and Division One and Power Four and all those kind of things. How did you handle, and I know it was a family thing, and that's again, that's a think, listen to this, guys, as you're listening, that this is a theme here, a family move. How did you, I'm going to say this kind of bluntly, handle coming, air quotes here, make sure you're hearing me say air quotes, down to NAIA? You coming from Duke, ACC, going up against your old boss, by the way, Bob Raven. And now you go to Ottawa. No one, I said it was in Kansas because I lived in Kansas. I coached in Kansas, so I knew it was there. 99% of the people listening had no clue where they're like, oh, Canada? Is that where Ottawa University is? How did you handle ego-wise of like, oh, the same things I got at Duke. I don't get over here at Ottawa.
I was a Division III athlete. I was a Division III recruiting coordinator, right? So here I am, like, okay, well, I'm gonna make the most of this moment. I'm coaching, I'm got a full-time job, do the family route, but I've made the connections, right? I have at this time in my career, I still have Andrea in my corner. I have Norm, and then through Andrea, I had other coaches that I could call up any point. At that point, I made a really good relationship with Martin Smith too, so I've got these coaches who I always say are kind of in my back pocket, right? Who are mentors, I can call up at any moment. I can have, so I'm like, okay, I'm going down for family move, but I still have these kind of people in my corner that if I need or if I wanted to ever explore that route later on, it allowed me to step in there. And I saw a lot of D1 coaches, like, it's hard to have a young family, right? So I was like, if I go down to NAIA, right, most of the time you're leaving in the morning, you're competing, you come back same day. I have a lot of flexibility. I could do what I need to. I'm closer to family where we've got family help. So when I'm gone, you know, my ex at the time had family on deck. So like, come help out with the kids, come take them to things. So to me, it was like, this will make my life easier and allow me to be a better coach because we have more help. So to me, it was kind of like a life balance, kind of like, okay, if I,
Huge. Absolutely. No, no. And you're kind of painting my picture for me. That's huge, huge. You know, now, and I didn't realize how big that was until I had children as well. So now I look at them like whenever someone tells me they're moving this school to this school, or, hey, I'm getting married, or we're having children. It's always like, oh, where's family? Like, are you getting closer to family, farther from family? Because trust me, as much as you may like or dislike your in-laws, and thank God I love my in-laws and they love me, it is always better to have family near for the children and things like, it's just, no matter what your career is, but certainly for coaching, it's huge. It's huge. Okay. 3 years at Ottawa. Where do we go from Ottawa?
And then Andrea calls me up.
Finally, you're at Toledo.
So she calls me up and she's going to take the director job at Toledo and says, hey, do you want to get the band back together?
Is that what she really said? That'd be funny.
Oh, that's what she said.
That's awesome. So, I love it.
Because we kept in touch, like, her and I were close. I actually used to take my kids up and go have like family little week with her because she was at Iowa State at the time. Right, so it's like a three and a half hour drive.
Yep.
But I'd go up. I used to actually help. And this is how I first met Coach Smith. I used to go up and either pace and rabbit that Iowa State Classic, that indoor meet they had.
Oh, yeah.
I'd help them set up for home meets. I help them set up their regional cross country meets. Like, to me, I just love the sport. So I'd go up and stay with Andrea and her family, bring my kids up and help them prepare to host a meet.
Right.
So I was just all hands on deck type guy. And so Andrea calls me. She's like, I'm going to take this job. Do you want to come with me? And I turned my wife at the time, now my ex, but I turned her and I was like, hey, this is me to get back into Division I. This is my next step. This is what we always wanted. And she was like, yeah, this is why we came down to NAI. Now our kids are older. They're out of diapers. Mm-hmm. They're moving. Like, this is your dream. Let's do it. So we went to Toledo and I was there for almost 4 years.
Yeah. And you know, I have a special place in my heart for Toledo because I coached at Ball State, that MAC conference. In fact, I was just hanging out with a couple of MAC guys. Can't remember who it was, dang it. But we were talking about, you know, I was there in the 2001-2002 era when Kevin was at Toledo and Wendell was at Kent. And, you know, we just had, Sue was at Ball State. Now she's up at Eastern. And, that conference it always felt like, when I was in it and still to this day, felt like the little conference that could. And that seems like it's kind of a slam on it, but it's like it punches above its weight. Like, there's all excuses in the world for the MAC to not be that great in track and field. You know, we dropped almost every men's program throughout the conference, which sucks. It's a conference that wants to be a Power Five, right? They're always trying to figure out how to make their football teams bigger and better. And so they're always, you know, putting a lot of resources into those sports. And then the track just outperforms. There's all Americans every year. There's a national champion almost every year, and something, the throws are amazing. Distance, all of it. There's sprinters. Like, it's really an amazing conference. How did you enjoy at Toledo, going against Bowling Green and Ball State and Akron and Kent, man, just some dogs, man. They're just amazing.
Yeah, no, I loved it. And Andrea and I are still like, it's like family to me, right? I can't say enough about her, right? And that experience. So yeah, I loved it. I loved my time at Toledo. I also knew, though, like you said, I was working more with the men. Like, I helped her. I was helping out with the steeple. I helped the middle distance women there, but I coached the men's cross team. And mm-hmm. We didn't have a track program. So the frustrating part for me personally and professionally was there was always going to be a ceiling or a cap. Mm-hmm. And, I explained it to the director at the time before I left, the athletic director, and I had a sit down talk. And I was like, it's kind of like you win the Olympic gold. Like, there, we were back-to-back runner-up conference champions. We had guys who could qualify for a regional system if they had a track program. And now we're in a position to win a MAC title. I go, where do we go from here? I'm now associate head coach. I'm making the most, there's a ceiling cap on how much you're going to make at the mid-major. And, so I'm like, I'm paid the most I'm going to be paid. I'm at the highest title I'm going to be paid. The men's team is having success. The women's team, we get back to nationals. So I almost felt like, there, especially how young I was in my career, how young I still feel I was when I left there, I still felt like, okay, we just reached a lot of what we're going to reach, like the pinnacle of it. And there wasn't much more. So to me, I always knew there had to be more, like I needed more growth. I needed to be able to kind of continue to move on or feel, you know, at that point, I think if I was 10, 15 years down the road, maybe it's a job you just continue to have fun at, continue to be successful at. I just wanted a little bit more. Right. So I still love the Toledo program. I think they've got a really cool setup. I love the MAC conference. I think they are, you know, and not to say this in a bad, I just thought like it was holding back the men's side of, you know.
No one can argue that. I mean, we've dropped, like I said, almost every men's program in the, I think we're down to four teams last time I looked. Four, maybe it's five, but it's not, it's a full slate of, what, 12 or 14 total schools, and, having four or five programs. I mean, it's ridiculous what they've done with men's track and field inside that conference. That is one of the big knocks for the MAC for sure. So no one can, no one can say, oh yeah, no, we support men's track. No, we don't. We are killing men's track have killed it in that conference. Okay, so little similarities here, because you go from Toledo to Alabama, right? You didn't sneak in, Syracuse University or anything here. Okay, good. Because I remember, my whole goal when I was coaching track and field was to make it to the SEC. I grew up in Alabama, so I was an SEC homer. I still am an SEC homer. I tell everybody, if they do a national championships for tiddlywinks, I guarantee you that some school from SEC would win. I just believe SEC would win everything. I'm a full-fledged SEC homer in regards to that. So I remember specifically, being at Appalachian State in the summer at USATF level two, and Al Schmidt pulls me out of class. Dennis Shaver was my teacher, pulls me out of class and says, congratulations, you're a Bulldog. They had hired me, so I was going to start, 1 week later or whatever. And I remember just, the feeling of like, oh, I made it. Like, this has been everything I've been working for is to get to the SEC. And here I am. I am at 28 or whatever I was. I am an assistant coach in charge of sprints, jumps, and hurdles at an SEC school. Like, it's still one of the, feathers in my cap, if you will. How did you get to Alabama? How did you get find? How did you find out you got the job? Tell us, because a lot of people listening now are like, okay, Nick did it. Nick went from Toledo to SEC to Alabama, so I can too. How did you do it? Tell us about that process.
All those people I had in my corner who I told you, like, I really believe in this. So when I was looking at jobs, applying for jobs, I didn't call up all the people that I've made along the way and ask them, hey, call this school, because I applied for a lot of Division I schools when I was at NAIA, volunteer, everything, but I never called in favors because I felt like if a coach came across my resume, came across, and they thought I was worthy enough, they'd go to my references and they'd make the calls themselves. If they skipped over it, I'm not ready for it yet. I might be frustrated, I might think I'm ready for it, but for some reason, I'm probably not ready for it yet. So that was my view on it. Like, a lot of people get frustrated and they're like, oh man, I deserve this, I need this, or hey, I'm going to call in a favor. If I've got to call in a favor, I want it to be the one, or I want to feel like I'm ready, or I feel like I'm in the moment. So the old coach that was here left, obviously mid-year, took over another position.
There's another theme, by the way, with
Yeah,
you, Nick.
right?
People that
January.
leave in December, man. Nick is ready to step up in January.
It's my opportunity. So they left. So I actually reached out to Coach Waters myself before I called in my references, and he actually responded back to me.
Did you know Coach at all?
I've met him at that point twice, but never had like a full-on conversation with him. Know him through Grapevine. But if you know anything about Coach Waters, he's going to do his due diligence and he's going to do his background. He's going to do his homework. He's a very meticulous guy and in a great way. Like he does the X's and O's, right? Like he'll dot his I's and cross his T's. So when I sent him a message and he responded back, then I went and I was like, okay, this is a job finally at my point in my career where I'm going to call. I called Coach Brayman, called Coach Smith, called Andrea. I was like, hey, I need a favor. I think I'm ready for this. This is what's open. Can you guys help me? And so then from there, it just kind of just excelled a little bit faster, obviously, because they needed the coach, but they weren't sure if they were going to bring somebody in there or wait until June. And so next thing you know, I'm getting an interview, going through the process, and I was like, okay, this is a time. And what probably helped me being in the MAC, and this is what I explained to Coach Waters at the time, is I was the men's coach. Yeah, I helped recruit with the women, and I was helping Andrea, but she was the women's coach, and I was helping with steeple and middle distance, but Andrea could coach all those. So I was like, "Coach, if there's any time for me to leave," and he was worried about taking another coach mid-year, kind of like he lost. He didn't want to do that to another program, which I respect a lot. But I even said to him, I said, "Coach, we don't have outdoor track. We don't have indoor track." So like I'm helping her, but we've got three distance coaches here because I had a part-time assistant at the time. I was like, he can step into my role. Andrea's still got help. It kind of works out because my season was done. Yes, I'm still coaching. Yes, I'm still helping the women's program. But I go, if anything, now's a great time for me to kind of step into another role, and it's not really going to hinder the program I'm at. And I'm ready for it. And so coach made his calls, did his things, and he's like, "Hey, your references and people called." And he goes, "I even called people you didn't have on your reference sheet. I called people, and they were saying that you can do this, and you're the next guy, and whatever." So I really, really am thankful and feel blessed and appreciative of coach taking that chance on me and giving me this opportunity, and putting me in this role. And yeah, I showed up first day, and he's like, "Hey, you got him. Like, take him. You're the women's coach. You do whatever. I'm taking the mitt. Like, just take him and run from there." And he put a lot of trust and faith in me, and I can't thank him enough for that. And now here we are, and yeah, to this day, I feel blessed. So, yeah.
So before I get into more into Dan, pause that real quick because this is really important. People again think that because you're the GA at Florida State, you get any job that you want and things like that, or a job is posted. Here's what I see a lot. There's one thread on Let's Run's message board that I pay attention to. I know everybody shakes their head. I know. But there's one thread that I do every day, literally every day. I will check this one thread, and that's the annual coaches thread. As much as and there's some, full disclosure, terrible, terrible things that are said on there.
Yeah.
However, there are people who are in the know who are on that thing too. So this is my way of just keeping up with, coaches and who they're going. And my favorite thing to do is when a coach, for the first time gets bashed on Let's Run, if I know them well, which most people, I'll call them up and be like, "Hey, congratulations. Like, now you've officially made it.
You
Now that
made
you've
it.
been bashed on the message board,
Yeah.
You should put that on your resume. Like, was bad. Here's the quote. I'm a terrible coach, but whatever." Anyway. But so a big theme on that thread is every job that's posted. In fact, this was just posted yesterday. Every job that's posted, especially the big schools, they've already got their candidate in mind. So I want to talk about, because you were not the candidate in mind. He didn't, you didn't have a relationship with Dan, et cetera. So I want to talk about that. Pause for a second, though. You mentioned, "Hey, I'm going to call in my cadre. I need my help. I need my Martin, my Norms, et cetera, Bobs to help out here." You also said Andrea. Did Andrea support you pursuing this job?
Oh yeah.
That's important because that's a myth. That's a myth. That's a myth that a head coach is always going to be selfish. Because even though you had an assistant that could take your position, you're still limited resources at Toledo. So every person leaving is a hurt, right? You had value. So if you leave, if it was easy for you to leave, it's like, well, you didn't really have any value there. You didn't really add anything. You certainly were going to create a missing void when you left. So Andrea, selfishly, self-preservation could have been like, "I know, Nick, you need to stay here for this reason, that reason, talk. Hey, I worked at Iowa State, man. Those big schools, they'll chew you up, spit you out, man. You're gonna make impact here at Toledo." She could have done all those things. Instead, what I'm hearing is she supported you in your career advancement here.
She was probably my biggest supporter. Well, not probably. She was my biggest supporter. Because her and I sat down and talked, even before I sent that email to Coach Waters, like I went and talked to her about it. Her and I have a great relationship with that. And she was like, she did that in her career too, right? She went, took the Iowa State. So she was like, "Yeah, I get that." And I didn't have that opportunity yet in my career. And I didn't have that, that feather in the cap, as you were saying. And, I talked to her on why and how, and yeah, I was comfortable there, and we'd probably still be there, and I'd be happy, and we'd be successful. And, I kind of felt like I needed that next step, and she knew that. It wasn't an easy decision too, even by the way, at the end of the day, but she was my biggest supporter. And
I love
even
that.
with Dan, had many calls with him. And she told me this later on. It took her a while too. She told called me about, I want to say it was that summer after NCAAs, Mercy and Hilda go on and they're all Americans, and Flo was an all American indoor, and we had some good success. And she called me, and she, I went back and saw her that summer and stayed with her and her family. And she told me, she goes, back when Dan was making decision, you know, I could tell it was going to be you because he called me and he was like, "Hey, is he ready for this? Can he do this? Can he?" And she goes, "You want to know what?" She goes, "Don't hire him. Do me a favor." She said this to the coach. She goes, "Don't hire him because," she goes, "he's awesome. He does everything we need. He's an awesome coach. He's an awesome guy. Don't hire him. Make my life easier. Make my job easier. Have him stay here." And that stood out to me because I was like, man, yeah, it could have made it. Like, we had a really good thing going and we had a great setup and we know each other. Like, I know what she's thinking in the back of my hand. Like, we have a great rapport. And I was like, it could make her life as a director a lot easier. And here she is advocating for me and doing it because she knew for me it was really good. And I'm always going to love her for that and appreciate her for that. But yeah, she was my biggest supporter and advocate for getting this job.
Yeah, she gets a big shout out. Because again, that's coaches coaching coaches and thinking not of themselves, but thinking of others. And typically we that gets acted out through our athletes. But here's a great example of our staffs of, hey man, this is what's best for you. You want this. So you know what? I want it for you. And you know, we'll be fine. We'll survive. We'll figure it out. But if this is what's best for you, then how can I help? How can I support? So I love that because that busts one of those myths of like, you know, someone is not going to help you to get another job. In fact, here's Andrea, you know, being your one of your biggest cheerleaders for it. So shout out to her, man. That shows true leadership. When you are willing to hurt yourself to help another, to me that is an alternate definition of leadership, man. I love that. So big shout out to her. Okay, now let's get back. Let's unpause this. You didn't have a relationship with Dan thing because that is a big myth, maybe the biggest myth we have in coaching for as a profession is that you have to know the other person. They've already got their person picked out. It's a formality. It's because of law that they actually put the job description out there. If they didn't have to do that, they wouldn't. They would just go hire their buddies or whatever. And instead, here you are. You didn't, you know, you'd met Dan, but you didn't know Dan. You didn't have a relationship with Dan. You didn't work Dan's camps, things like that. And you earned the job. I love that. That shows a lot of character on both your sides. You know, I have a lot of like I almost said like hidden or secret respect for Dan. I've told Dan I respect him, so it's not that hidden. But you know, Dan and I have not done any significant business together. So it's not like Dan's a big Gil guy and he buys all of our stuff, right? And so he has all reasons because he's extremely busy. And to your point, you know, very thorough and meticulous. He has all reason to kind of push me to the side. And I was down visiting Tuscaloosa one year, and you know, even though he doesn't buy anything from me, I like to stop it, you know. I don't like you or not like you because you do or don't buy stuff from me. So, you know, just stopped in and say hi. And he was like, "Hey, do you want a tour?" And I was like, "All right, he's gonna give me the 5 minute, you know, good job, Mr. Sales Guy. Now get out of here, tour, right?" Dan, I think we spent over an hour. Took me through the football the facility and then obviously to the track and things like that. And it just struck me of like, man, Dan, you want nothing from me. So you're not trying to butter me up for better price and things like that. It was really out of servitude of like, oh, I'm proud of our facility. You know, you're a human being, Mike. I'll show you around. And I was just really struck. It just really, there's others like a Dan in regards to business who won't give me the time of day. And maybe they just don't like me. That's okay. I know not everybody likes me. I'm okay with that too. But it really struck me of Dan's outwardness of that, of like, you know, acceptance, regardless of what, you know, business-wise, we may or may not do. So I can see him being very thorough in an interview process. How did that process go? Let's give some value to people who are listening here in the next last few minutes here. What did you have to do to prepare? Was it a formal interview? Did he want to see your logs of training? Talk to us a little bit about kind of that. Like, how did you, what was that process like so other people might be prepared for future interviews like yours?
Yeah, well, Coach Waters, like I said, I mean, probably every question he was going to ask me, he probably already knew the answer to,
Hey,
knowing him.
that's like your dad, right? Lawyers never ask a question they don't already know the answer to, right? Dan would have been a good lawyer now that I think about it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh yeah. Tell him
Oh,
that
yeah.
when we get done. I want to hear what his reaction is when you tell
Yeah.
him that. Okay.
So he's a hard read. Like, I will tell you this, he is, like, now that I know him, I'm starting to really pick up on, like, but he was a hard read. I couldn't tell. Like stone cold face, like I came prepared, by the way. So all those positions, all those jobs, all those, I came with an action plan. I came with first year recruiting plan, second year recruiting plan, how I'm going to train, where I'm going to, what areas I want to work on, everything. Like I came detailed, right? Like I went to the works for this. And I could tell he appreciated and respected that. And then I remember he handed me this big, we got this big binder and book.
I know this binder. Hold on, hold on. So when Dan first got there, he hired a good friend of mine, Matt Cain. And so one of my visits, I'm sitting in the office with Matt, and I'm like, "So Matt, so how's it working with Dan? You know, a Pat Henry disciple, you know, Pat again's another one, very detailed." And he reaches almost exactly like you were doing right there. He reaches behind and grabs this binder. And I said, "Oh yeah, I remember. Yep. His was thicker. Maybe Dan's getting a little you know, a
Well,
little light in his age here."
how many? I've got 18 tabs here.
I tell Matt, I go, "Oh yeah, I got that when I got to Mississippi State too, you know, all the HR stuff." And he goes, "Oh no, brother, this isn't from the University of Alabama." He goes, "This is Dan." He goes, "This is every meet, every schedule, what we're wearing, everything detailed out." So I love that he's still the binder guy. That's so awesome.
He handed that to me. So I showed up for my interview and he just picks me up and takes me to the hotel because the interview is going to start the next day. He hands it to me in the car. So what I do, being me, and I already got my action plan, I studied it that night. I stayed
100%.
up.
100%. I
I
mean,
stayed
that's like
up
a
for
guy
like
giving
2 hours.
you the playbook before the play. Yeah, absolutely. You better read that. Absolutely.
So I think I spent like 3, 4 hours studying it. I'm like, I just don't want to be able to flip back and refer to it. I want to be able to recall it. So when we're
Right.
having talking, be like, oh yeah, I remember you do this with your program, you do that. You and
Smart, smart, smart.
so I did that. So I went like I'm all in. Like, and I wanted him to know, like, I'm not just coming down here interviewing, I'm not just getting this notch on my belt. Like
Right.
I want this. And I
Yeah.
remember calling him and telling him that. And like after, you know, he called and he did his follow-up. And I was like, hey, just so you know, coach, like, why am I not the guy for this? Why don't you want, you know? And I was like, I'm just gonna be as straightforward as I can be, right? Like I can tell this is a guy that, you know, he doesn't take BS, he doesn't give BS, he doesn't, you know, so why am I gonna do
Right.
that to him? So
Right.
no, and I have a lot of appreciation and respect for him. You know, I watch him and you know he forgot about this, but he remembers it now. When I came for my interview, the next day we were driving around, we were doing things. He's taking me on the tour, he's driving me around town. And then we had to make a stop and we picked up balloons for his kid's birthday party on my interview. That stuck out to me. Like that to me was like, okay, I saw this and I saw a genuine side to him and I saw this fun side to him and I saw this dad side to him and I saw, but I was like, and he's still successful and he's still very serious and he's still accomplished. But he's not just accomplished in just track and field.
Right.
And I, you know, even now, like the other day coming home, like setting up for a meet week, as you know, is all, like I love meets. I hate hosting. It's, but like we're all go and I can tell he's stressed and we've got all these moving pieces. And he calls and he's, and I'm on my way home and we're sitting through traffic and he's just like, hey, how you doing? And I'm like, I'm good, coach. He's like, hey, I know you've got to do this for the meet tomorrow. Just do your thing. You know how it goes. Just set it up. I try, you know. And he goes, just wanted to let you know, I really appreciate you. And I'm like, man, okay, this is why. Like, we can go through war, we can go through battle, we can go through the trenches, and there's gonna be good days and bad days. But at the end of the day, like, that was a genuine phone call. That was a genuine appreciation, good response. And I go, that's what I want from a leader, too. Like, yeah, times is gonna be hard. Like, don't get me wrong, there's gonna be hard days, and there's gonna be days you're gonna be firm, and there's days we gotta be better, and you gotta push everyone to be better and step up and elevate. But then there's also gonna be like, hey, we're humans too, and we're people, and we also gotta enjoy this. So, like, yeah, that's just a recent example of like I knew it was the right decision.
You know, we're going to wrap up here because we both have to go. One of the subjects I wanted to get into, and maybe I just need to have Dan on the show to actually talk about this, but you know, his recruiting style is and philosophy is on record of being very family focused. And I don't mean, oh, we want people who are going to come in and be our family here at Alabama, et cetera, but centered around his family, meaning, you know, you've got to be family first. I know coaches, we make it our identity, and that's our number one role. When in reality, we're fathers, brothers, sons, daughters, spouses, first. We are, you know, coaching is probably your fifth role, especially as a father. Your coaching is a fifth role, and I think Dan takes that very seriously, all the way up into how he actually runs the program. And I think it's a lesson that we could and should learn throughout our entire profession. So maybe I just need to have him on here. So we're gonna cut it short a little bit here, Nick.
Thank you.
Thank you, man. This is fascinating. I love having, you know, I do love these journeys as we continue to evolve the podcast. I love having these real conversations about the profession, because I, you know, we want this to be an impact on the sport through our coaches positively. And I think helping our coaches become better by sharing experiences like this, you don't get to share this experience and the experiences that you've had very often. So I think being able to share those makes our profession better. So I'm really grateful for you and your openness, your honesty. It's a great lesson for people. There's people listening right now that are going to be better because of hearing your journey. And we're just grateful for you sharing that with us today.
Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity and for bringing me on here, and really appreciate what you do for our sport and for coaches in general. And, you know, thank you for everything. So I'm really happy. I'm looking forward to hopefully continuing this, and, you know, we can always follow up down the road, but yeah, no, thank you.
Absolutely. You deserve it, by the way. That's why I do it. At the end of the day, you, Nick, deserve it because of what you do, the positive impact you make on young people, man. You really, really do. So, hey, thanks for being here. Join us next week. I'm going to cut this short because I got an interview to go do. I got to go do an intern interview here for Gil. So I got to run there. Nick, thank you. Appreciate your time. Good luck this weekend. And come back next week. We'll do it all over again. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate it.
If it goes to appreciate the coach, the ones who point people most. Every season needs a voice of reason, speaking of growth. You gotta prep before you carry the load. It's coffee to the soul for those of us who stay on the go. Proper handoff to stay in the zone. What you packing for the road? There's more than one way to go. Take notes, that's paying your toll. It ain't practice if your purpose ain't clear. It can't happen till you listen with both ears. You can't mentor without a mentor's years of experience, so you can reinvent those years. Every plan's got a standard to live up to. And the price sacrifice, can you give up you? It's a choice and a fight, not a win or lose. It's not a ploy, but advice so y'all can make more moves. It's not about how to, it's all about why. You don't know till you know who you are inside. 6 million ways to tie, choose none. So we all cross the finish line, the work ain't done. So we learn from the experts, we all gotta put in the legwork. Gil Athletics is a network, it's all about connections. Put together for the profession, so every track coach can be blessed.